guests from the National Trade Rally, as well as the dialogue by Ms. Maleni, and as well as Ruida. Okay, Ruida. And as well as the Department of Human Settlements, led by DG. I think they are old friends there. PMG, I'm sure PMG is here with us. Who else? Salga. Yeah, those are our old friends. Yes, wherever we are, they are there. Honorable members, you are welcome this morning. And fortunately, I think your agenda is very, very short today. It has been trimmed. So it's up to you if you want to utilize that opportunity to just cut your meeting short for once, Mr. Steen. We are going to receive a presentation from the National Treasury. We have requested them, in fact, we always request them to come and assist the Portfolio Committee, to empower, in fact, the Portfolio Committee on the side of the budget. Because looking at those figures there in those huge books, sometimes it's not easy to interpret some of the issues. And sometimes we find it difficult even to link with them with the State of the Nation address. So we normally request them to assist us to unpacking some of the issues. For instance, we know that we do have a new grant during this period that has been allocated to human settlements, known as the Urban Settlement Grant. As well, I think one of the other issues that we have to be assisted with is the issue of the accreditation of the municipalities and other issues in the DORA bill. Because you know that we are doing oversight to the Department of Human Settlements. So it's an amusion to us. Because that is supposed to be that. Empowerment means you are giving up a tool to do your oversight properly. And at some stage, you'll find that we normally receive the reports from the Auditor General. What about again? You are welcome. Sometimes we normally receive reports from the Auditor General with comments to say your department has not complied with certain regulations, and the National Treasury regulations is one of those regulations that they are normally quoted. So I think the National Treasury, we have to thank them because they are always there with us playing that role of empowering us. And if I remember last year, we had a very good strategic planning as the Portfolio Committee where the National Treasury came to our meeting. So with those few words, we are going to hand over to the National Treasury. After the presentation, we are going to interact. But there are questions at some stage that we feel that the department, as the department is accounting to us, they have to respond to other questions of which the National Treasury cannot respond. We are the people who crack the whip to the department. their role is just to empower us, giving us information so that we track them. It's not National Treasury or Treasury Department, it's us. And the National Treasury is not here for us to lobby for extra funds. This is not the period. We do have our own share during the RRR period, because the money bills is there that allows us to change or to change the budget. So when we are engaging with them, let's not put pressure on them to say, why have you taken this money and you put it there? Why have you not done this and this and that? Our questions must be clear on the empowerment and as well as the regulations that are there, that we can look at them so that we track the whip properly. Thank you very much, Rada. When I'm Ms. Nali.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I feel like on the spot because I don't want to feel like I'm helping the whip to be cracked in any way. The presentation attempts to respond to the request for more understanding, particularly with regard to the human settlement grant, the urban settlement development grant, and the rural household infrastructure grant. We will touch a bit on the budget, but I don't think we are touching that much of the details. I think any further details can be answered, and the good thing is that the department is here to answer those details. So what I'm going to do is just to quickly just set a scene that really begins to map out how, you know, the thinking and the evolution of the thinking with regard to, in our view, with regard to the establishment of the settlement grant and rural settlement grant. She will touch on municipal accreditation. Yeah, then she will touch on municipal accreditation. So basically what I'm going to do, therefore, is try to map out the landscape with regard to the human settlement in relation to urban. Because what I'm talking about here is what I consider to be an urban challenge and also a rural challenge. Because sometimes when you talk about the cities and the urban, there's a view that maybe there's too much focus on the cities. I think what I want to bring across here is to say that it's not an issue of there is a focus in the cities or in the rural. I think for us it's an issue of what is the appropriate response to the urban city problem. And that will be informed by how then we understand the problem in the cities in relation, for instance, your concern here with regard to human settlement. But when you talk about sustainable human settlement, then we begin to talk about many other things that have to do with growth of the cities, better integration of people in the cities, access to infrastructure, access to opportunities, which then goes beyond just the house, but more around the built environment, how it functions, and out of that, there's an emergence of sustainable settlement for the poor people. So then we'll talk a little bit about the budget as it is now, and then the urban settlement development grant. And then I'll have a bit of more comments also around the rural issue, and then say how the rural grant attempts to respond to the rural challenge. Then we'll talk to municipal accreditation. So I think by way of a background, I think since the 4 years one has been involved in this process, there has really been a lot of thinking to say that, you know, government has made progress with regard to delivery of infrastructure to address the backlog and also with regard to housing. but still much needs to be done. I think the housing backlog at the moment is estimated at around 3 million or so. So the issue is, you know, in taking this issue further forward of really creating, you know, a better life for all, what is it that the government needs to be doing and how, you know, going forward? And some of the questions really have been, how can the government now build on its progress that it has achieved so far in order to reach these objectives of inclusive and sustainable growth? And I think what I'm going to highlight here also is to show that while delivery of infrastructure and growth has happened, but it has not really impacted in the poor in the way that government in this age, or maybe change the plight of the poor. So how can we similarly increasing backlogs in service delivery be tackled? And I think it's very clear that with housing, even though we have delivered almost like 2 million or so, but we have got increases actually in the housing backlog. That's a major. So how can this be tackled effectively? What are some of the important patterns and dynamics and the special trends that will influence the above? And I think this is where the citizen comes in. How can we move away from the special patterns created by apartheid legacy into a better pattern where the poor are more included in the city and in the growth? How can we ensure access to significant livelihood and service opportunities for the biggest number of the South African population? That talks a lot to sustainable internet settlement. Where does government need to focus to address this challenge of lack of resources, increasing energy costs and climate change, you know, and how does it put its focus? And I think this is where the strategy that differentiates the approach to cities and the approach to rural becomes quite critical as government seeks at the most effective ways in order to of addressing the problem and making an impact in the problem. So I think when we come to the human settlement landscape, I think here what you will see is, you know, broadly the categories in terms of the household profile over the years. So what you will see here is that almost over 50% of the people actually are earning almost less than 3,500 rands per month, and those are the poor people that are targeted by the housing subsidy. And then, but as you increase, you'll see that up to 8% is the range of people that are earning between 7,000 and 12,500. And I think below that range, you realize that almost 80% of the people there who lack houses in that category actually would be impacted one way or the other by the subsidy grant. But what you also realize is that within the scope of 7,500 range, is a range of people also that could have different and varying capacity to contribute towards their housing. And I think when you talk about the backyards, those are the people that probably you'll find most of them in there, and they're actually paying in terms of renting. So when you look at the households in terms of the stats, SA General Household Survey, you'll realize that the major problem that we are facing with is really the problem of your informal settlement, informal dwelling, which is the red bars over there. And I think while progress has been made, you can see that between 2002 and 2009, there actually generally has been an increase in the informal settlement household. So the other thing that you notice is the household migration patterns, that when you compare both the urban and the rural, you realize that there is population higher, more in the urban areas, I think around 60%, that's what this graph showed in 1996. And it's actually continued to increase in the urban space with increased migration. So you can see that in terms of your income and survey of saying, we do see that now we can talk about almost 65%. In the urban area, and a decline to below 40% in the rural areas. And I think with the survey now that we are conducting, the general survey that has been conducted, I think it's going to show that pattern even much more strongly because it is continuing to happen, urban and rural urban migration. Another thing that we want to show is around the backlogs. So when you look at the backlogs and comparing the cities and the rest of the municipalities, what you look at in the metros that housing is a major problem. This is where your housing is a major problem, and a lot of it has got to do with your informal settlement challenge. Now, when you look at the rest of the municipalities, the poorer municipalities outside of the 27 or so cities, you see that the major problem there is access to services with basic sanitation leading the peg there in terms of the backlog. So I think the question would be, having spent so much billions in infrastructure over the last 10 years or so, and how come we still have that major challenge in this area? So when you look at so we have already profiled this one. So in terms of the urban areas also, when you look at, you find that 41% of the households live in the 8 metropolitan municipalities, but 57% of the informal settlements are found in those areas. So there's a high concentration in there, and 8% of the backyard dwellers are also found in those the metros. But I think what is the challenge is that the current funding is not really responding properly to the challenge that the cities themselves are focusing, both in terms of the way MIC was, which had its own rules that were not linking it properly with your housing subsidy, and the way housing subsidy also is, that did not allow for these cities to actually begin to address this problem, because it has got a lot to do with their ability also to deliver on infrastructure. So hence, there isn't much progress all around. And I think this curve also shows what has been happening, that although the grant has been increasing over the years at much faster rate, but delivery has been falling at a much faster rate. And I think one of the issues there could be the increases in the size of the household and the cost. But I think also that misalignment also and also not being able to really find the proper solution that begins to enable the cities also to begin to move on what is actually a critical problem is one of the issues that contributes. But at the end of the day, the reality is delivery is going down whilst has been going down since 2006 and 2007, while actually the grant has been flowing. I think one of the other issues that one wants to bring out, besides seeing that delivery is going down and that we have not made much impact in the informal settlement, is also to begin to see how also inefficient our investment has been in the space. I think what you see in this diagram is the densities and the spatial patterns of different cities of the world. So when you look at here is your Jakarta, which has got 16 million, and 7 million in London and 8 million. In that space, when you compare the space of Gauteng, this is not just a municipality, Gauteng, your Gauteng region, you realize that actually there is a high level of concentration, a high level of density in these major cities. That 7 million people compared to your 8% in the space that they are occupying. So what you realize is the inefficiency in the investment that you have been making, also in the sense that the densities are somewhere outside of the major, of the center of the cities, and they are dispersed all over. And the job opportunities are also scattered all over. So as a result, people are started traveling long distances to jobs. That increases the time to travel. That increases the cost, you know, because usually they say that people must be at least on average 1 hour within the travel, within the between the job and the life, and must not spend more than 8% of their income. But I think poor people in South Africa spend almost up to 50% or more of their thing on income. So that means that if we continue with this investment, what you will see is that a lot of the investments also happened in the peripheries in terms of the housing, because that is where land is supposed to be cheaper, and that is where it is also for the housing departments of the provinces to actually deliver. And those are areas that are not actually helping the cities to begin to, you know, to densify and to address this problem of fragmentation between your labor and your job opportunities and the people. So if that continues, then it means that actually we are perpetuating the special challenge of apartheid. We are not bringing about inclusive cities that include people in bringing them closer to employment. And I think many cities in the world, that is how you develop. Densification also is a key towards addressing your energy challenge, because it means that people are not traveling long distances. You're also able to use more of the public transport. So the energy problem, the climate problem, you know, those are the issues that you find that are quite key in the cities, and you require that the cities must be able to bring about densification. And that also addresses bringing people closer to each other. Then we have got more culturally inclusive and integrated environments in that space. So, but that is not what has happened so far. So, and a part of the challenge, as we have been reviewing the operation of the system, has to do with how our fiscal instruments, the funding, has been arranged when it comes to the cities, and the functional assignment of the cities. And I think over the years, we have seen three major problems. That's what you see in the built environment, in the cities, which we believe that those are the key towards actually government achieving better integration. We don't actually believe that you can integrate at the national or at the provincial level. You are able to integrate at the city level, but it means that the functions must be properly assigned and the fiscal instruments must be properly aligned. And I think this has been a major problem. So what has happened is you have each department, you know, having their own grants, having their own rules in terms of how those grants are supposed to move. And those grants actually fund the programs that are part of the built environment, where the municipality has got to make some kind of a logic in terms of integration and alignment, your transport system and your land use and your housing, human settlement, how you also begin to drive the investment in the private sector and begin to align those with bringing people closer. And those are some of the decisions and trade-offs that actually can only be made at the music. But then when you have got the funding with different rules from transport, from treasury, from human settlement, from sports, then you actually have a problem in terms of their ability to integrate in the manner they plan. Besides also their capacity also, which they also have not developed fully to integrate, because the system has meant that they always are changing compliance to the rules of different grants. So the lack of transparency also of housing flows, I think also contributes towards inefficiencies. I think what we see is the cities will never know how much is going to be spent or how much is going to be transferred to them, and some of these transfers are made towards the end of the year, which we think is fiscal dumping. So that planning between the province and the cities also has not worked well, and therefore the result of poor performance. And that means that the spending is not properly focused to begin to achieve much that it could achieve. I think the other issue also has to do with the functions that are not properly located, because some part of housing is done in the provincial level, it's done at the municipal level. You have got land issues also being managed in different places. So you don't have proper, you know, location of function. So there's fragmentation. And the long-term view in terms of planning also it's lacking. So at the end of the day, when failure is there, nobody actually takes accountability when you don't have a very clear assignment of functions and responsibilities. So the other issue is externalization of costs. You know, because of the way land use management is happening and the issues around land processes, what you will find is that the reason why you would have also have a lot of settlement outside of the center of the cities is because that is where the land is cheaper. And then if the cities also are not properly equipped to begin to deal with the issues of the land, you know, within the cities and access, it becomes a major challenge to continue to put people where in the tariffs where actually infrastructure becomes much more expensive. Transport becomes more expensive. So the cost, even though the land may be cheaper, becomes quite expensive. But when land functions are also not properly located and clearly located, then the cities are also not able to begin to manage this. And I think the way in which also the subsidy is, they are also not flexible enough to begin to mobilize the private sector to begin to close the gap market. And as a result, everybody within that range is looking for a free house. And the challenge is government will never be able to address the problem. So the issue is, how does it mobilize, the individuals in the private sector to begin to find a solution? And we believe that that solution can be found if we can do the right things as government in this case, in order for us to achieve the optimal thing. So why do we believe that we need to get it right for the cities in terms of the problems that they have? We believe that a government cannot afford not to actually bring about a proper focus on this, because if you talk about growth, that is where the great potential for growth is going to be. At the moment, your 27 cities account for about 80% of our gross value added, and it is rising. And that is where a major tax collection comes from. And you, when you look at your major rural areas, it doesn't matter how much government invests, but you will never bring them to the point where they would actually be viable to the extent of independence. So there will always be a need for more money in the form of grants, more money in the form of infrastructure, more money in the form of, education, subsidies and stuff to the cities. And if you are not able, therefore, to make sure that where the major income is, this income is able to rise, then you actually will be able to see a fall also even in terms of ability of government to address the most poor area. So demographics also tell you, as I've already said, that, that there's a growing trend of the poor actually increasing in the cities. And some of them are just looking for opportunities, not even for housing opportunities. They are looking for job opportunities. They still want to go back home. And then cities are faced with huge pressures. I think some of the work that we have done shows that in terms of infrastructure, about $300 billion investment that they need, most of that to really address growth, to unlock growth. And the backlogs that we have talked about. I think here what you see is the budget of the department, and you can see that it has been growing almost by 11.4% on average over the MTF. And that growth comes largely as a result of your increases in the allocation of the conditional grants. As we know that now the department has got a new grant under its fold, which has brought some additional new money in the department. And you also would see the increase also on the agencies, I think. Yeah. So when you look at the grants, the agencies, where this is capitalization of nature, and this is also an attempt also to address the issues of social housing in that. But then this is your urban settlement grant and your human development grant. So I'll then say a little bit around urban development grant. Part of its creation is really informed by this background that I have already formed to say, how do we begin to progressively allow the cities to begin to plan in an integrated way so that actually we can actually begin to realize even this vision of sustainable human settlement, that could actually emerge out of the cities being able to plan and direct development in a way that they begin to restructure the city space to bring about more inclusiveness of the poor. And I think in terms of also, what happened historically is that there was a decision to within housing to say that the housing grant must only fund your top structure, and that in itself kind of created a gap in terms of the funding, because municipalities, there wasn't any additional funding that they were given. So it also created a bit of a challenge where there was inconsistency in terms of how this was addressed, with some places. Provinces still able to give the municipalities money to do the infrastructure, but it was inconsistent. So, and then what we also saw is with the outcome approach, there was a very clear articulation from the department around the need to actually begin to address informal settlement challenge, which we are saying that up to now it was actually not being addressed in the way. and they need to ensure that there's a link between your barrack connector services to the housing project, which was also some of the problems that has been a challenge. So the issue of the focus on the informal settlement. So the urban development grants, we believe that it is the first step of actually trying to bring some kind of logic in the manner in which we are funding the cities in order for them to begin to contribute towards your human settlement challenge, which also requires that they are able to drive growth in a particular way. They are able to change the structure and bring about better efficiency in transport so that the cost for transport can be lower and stuff. So it becomes the first step towards that. So we see this grant helping the city and the government in general to improve efficiency and coordination of investment within the built environment, that out of which sustainable human settlement would therefore emerge. Therefore, what the grant is doing is supplementing the capital budgets of large cities. We believe it will support the emergence of efficient special city structure that integrates the poor into the growing city economies. It will subsidize the cost of providing basic services to the poor. And some of the key measures of performance that you are looking at is that we are seeing a shift into area-based development. So this actually for us is about densification around public transport nodes, around economic corridors, which when you look at some of the city's plans, some of the things that they are already beginning about to do, that will then bring people closer to opportunities. So it's going to address the issues of land and the city's ability to secure land in the strategic areas. The issues of now the city of a sector and being able to link now with your human settlement grant for the top structure. Increase the security of Kenya irrespective of whether people have got a top structure or not. And part of our tracing from our settlement is that it gives people security of Kenya, and then they are able actually to begin to build their own house. Which we believe that actually a lot of these people in the informal settlement, actually, they are actually looking for land. And you know, when you look at, we had an opportunity to be going around and doing some visits in this program. And then you see that sometimes with this policy of 250 square meters for the yard, and the 40 square meters. So now, what happens is, that is actually large, 250 square meters. So what happens is, once people have got that, so immediately they start putting their own shacks, and that is for rental. So I was watching this thing in Ikorodeni, and I was saying, guys, what are you doing with this thing now? What's happening? Can you see what is happening now? It's like, it's either they do that or they build magnificent houses. Right, big houses, and then you realize this person did not actually need this thing. If you had given this person just land, serviced, they would have built a house. Now they are bringing their shacks, and now they tell me the municipality is fighting this thing because now they gave these people rather in a greenfield, moving them from these dolomite areas. You know that is the major problem in Kulin area. So now they want to clean, have a clean environment. This shacks are being, I'm like, but that is good. Because what they are doing, also they are identifying, it's also economic. But I mean, how do you come and say, I'm giving you this is yours, and then you can build your own shack? But the challenge is, after the years, you'll find that it's already like that. And it means it's something that they are responding. So that means there is actually capability there for people to actually go for rental houses. So which means you probably needed to have a mix housing solutions that enable people that can pay and need rental to begin to pay. But that's the opportunity that we are missing with government, but that's what the market begins to do for us, and then we want to fight it. So then performance-based and output-focused investments, that's what we are looking for. And the big thing that we're also looking for is begin to unlock the resources of the cities to increase, because I think that is the only area where government can begin to reduce its support and begin to make sure that the cities can grow their own revenue, which we believe is suboptimal, and that they can actually begin to go into borrowing more, which we believe is suboptimal. But there are certain things that we need to begin to do to unlock that, and that's what we're actually working on. So I think really the response that we believe is appropriate for the cities, and the issue is how do we further make sure that we are further aligning with your public transport infrastructure grant, neighborhood development grant, that we are bringing these things, bringing about the issues of the green city, the environment, climate issues, you know, to begin to bear in terms of how the cities are developing and how the human settlement sustainability is emerging. I think we believe that is the first step, but there is more that we still need to accomplish. So when we get to the rural areas, I think when you look at the deep rural, I mean, some 127 very rural spaces, it's where outside of the cities, it is where also there is higher concentration of poverty. But the households there are mostly relied on social grants, and really depends on the fiscal on the basic services and access to those basic services. But the big thing there is also capacity to deliver. And the challenge with the government has been spending billions on capacity building, but surely we haven't been able to crack that. So there's something that we have not done right. So the importation of urban-based solutions to address rural problems also has been something that we believe has not been appropriate and is unsustainable. The other issue around the land is land tenure and your rights. Land rights, which is a major problem to investment. But the other issue also is institutional arrangements, you know, the whole issue of your district versus locals. It is not actually working properly at the moment. So one of the things that we believe has been a policy failure was to adopt the one-size-fits-all. One-size-fits-all in how we deal with, you know, maybe housing, that we believe that, you know, housing is equally a need between urban and rural. One-size-fits-all in terms of how we deal with infrastructure investment. As a result, we have not actually properly targeted the rural areas. Firstly, you know, when you look at the towns, the rural towns, there's an issue of bulk infrastructure that has been addressed through the bulk grant. But one of the major challenges that we ask ourselves is whether network, because when we talk about bulk infrastructure, we are talking about network infrastructure that everybody would be, water would be piped. But what is very clear is that that is not actually necessarily a solution throughout the landscape of South Africa. And in fact, if we are to make that a solution, it's going to be something that government will never be able to afford, and will probably not even be able to afford it in the water that would have to run into that. But we believe that we are not doing enough in terms of water harvesting, we are not doing enough in terms of your underground water in these areas. So because of these challenges, what has been happening with NIC is that you have been delivering mostly in your rural towns, not necessarily in these villages that are sparse all over, that actually need different solutions to your piping solutions. Hence, you see that the backlogs are still very huge. So now, what the Rural Infrastructure Grant was attempting to actually begin to get the government to respond much more directly to impact in those areas that are actually outside of your small towns, in a way. So, and the issue there was then how do you actually begin to strengthen community-based delivery mechanisms, in a way. That will then contribute towards employment creation, but also sustainability of this infrastructure. And then encourage investments that are appropriate technology. At the moment, when you talk about on-site solutions, people think it's a low level. And I think politically something that still needs to be much more conversed, that it's not low level. It is actually an appropriate solution that makes sure that this person that cannot pay for the services, that is sitting somewhere where the pipe water may never reach, actually is able to have a decent toilet, you know, and a decent access to water in a manner that is sustainable for government to maintain. So we believe that that is an appropriate. So one of the things that also is happening is to look at how parastatals can support rural development. I think DBSA is doing a lot of work in this area. The grant system also to allow greater involvement and the leadership of the sector departments. So what is also happening is that through COCTA there is a process of creating what is called Municipal Infrastructure Support Agency. This is actually aimed to supporting infrastructure delivery in the weak capacity, mostly municipalities. That will also impact a lot on your water and sanitation. So it is the process that is evolving, which we hope it will be functional in the next year. So the rural grant was then focused on eradicating rural sanitation, you know, over 3 years. So it allows for use of appropriate on-site solutions. It also aims to facilitate community involvement in the creation and maintenance of these assets. This would create community ownership, community employment, but also ensure sustainability, as I have already mentioned. So, but what we have seen with the grant, that there has been poor performance in the grant. It hasn't been spending. And we believe that it's because of, you know, the function shift that has contributed that this grant, the function shifted from water, thank you, from the water sector, that had already have established institutional setup to deliver on something like this. To the Department of Housing, that does not have that institutional setup, which has been largely just a policy department. We believe that probably that is where maybe the problem is, and unless that challenge is addressed somehow, we remain with the problem in that while the money is there, the money has been cut, because we had to reduce this money also and then extend this process for another year, you know, so that we give the system time to adjust into this thing. But the principle is it was an attempt to respond towards a rural challenge. She will talk to Minister of Agriculture.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Well, we're aware that Section 156 of the Constitution says that when a function needs to be efficient, currently we have human settlements as a concurrent local, provincial and national function, but where it makes sense for the function to be devolved to municipalities, the function should do so. And this is supported by the Housing Act. What accreditation is built on is basically it recognizes that the center of coordination for all community development is the municipality. And the principle that this was built on was by delegating the functions in a logical way, allowing for accountability when the responsibility is shifted, and then it takes into consideration the capacity issue, which is a big thing for the sector, is how do you ensure that the program continues when you change the institutional arrangements. And basically we have three levels of accreditation, and we all know about that, but I mean the critical bit is here is what happens when the function is assigned. Currently we don't have any municipality where the function has been assigned to, but we have municipalities at varying degrees within the system. I think there's a critical bit in the division of revenue role is that we've come prepared for a level three accreditation. And what this really means is that how do we shift money from one sphere of government within the division of revenue to another sphere of government? And the big bit on that is highlighted in section 15 of the division of revenue bill, where we basically, I mean, it says quite explicitly that when you have to move money, if the function is assigned between provinces and municipalities, we have a process to stop the money, regazette the money, and reallocate it to the municipality. I think everything that we've done within the division of revenue bill speaks to how we then move the money and the process that it takes to move the money, which is not very different from how we stop and reallocate money between provinces. So I mean, the provisions have been made in the bill itself and within the conditional grant framework on reporting, so that which supports the accreditation in when the responsibility moves, that you get the accountability that goes with that on reporting on financial and non-financial matters with respect to the grant. And that, I mean, despite all of this, I mean, despite all these provisions, we still have the department is really keen on the accreditation, and they've really taken the leadership in ensuring that the Housing Act and the Division of Revenue is complied with. And like I said earlier on, that we do have municipalities at varying states in the system, with some of the metros at level one, some we don't have status on, and then we have some of the municipalities in the two new emerging metros also at level one accreditation.
Okay, by way of conclusion, so what we are saying is that government acknowledges the need to change the approach to obviously addressing your rural problem, but also to how we address the managing of the built environment. And that requires that we treat the cities differently and also treat the other group of municipalities differently. In the cities, is around how do you consolidate the fiscal instruments to enable better integration and consolidation at the city level. And I think what we see is that the funds need to flow direct to large cities, and I think that is where USDG is beginning to do that. That will then fund the plans and programs that have been approved by, you know, national departments led by human settlements. Because we must remember now, this is not just about human settlement, because we talk about how they deal with transport, how do they deal with other things, how they deal with land, you know. So for us to begin to do that, we see that human settlement really helping us to pull this, it's an opportunity to help us to pull all this investment in the manner in which that we are able to achieve the objective of sustainable human settlement. However, the USDG approach still, we believe, still does not fully recognize the capacity of large cities to plan and leverage funds, because we still have other functions that are not certain in terms of how the money will flow. For instance, your public transport money and stuff, it still does not provide certainty in the amount of money that will flow to the city to enable better integration and delivery, and more so leveraging of funding to the cities. But it still also does not limit the role of provinces to direct housing developments in other areas that sometimes are not necessarily fitting with the and aligned with the plans of the cities to begin to respond with infrastructure. So we believe that we still need to further deepen a consolidation of functions and the funding stream for the cities. And this really requires that the whole issue of your devolution of aggregation of the housing function needs to be considered. But I think beyond that is an issue also how you look at even the subsidy instruments. That at the moment it's not flexible at all. It still kind of channels them towards the full stand house in that particular way. So we believe that flexibility to begin to choose which way to address the problem need also to begin to reconsider. So hence, I think the issue of how you look at the policy becomes something that becomes quite critical. So the other thing that we still have to look at is how we deal with these other grants that are related but still flowing in a different way. And then how do we then begin to deepen that partnership with the cities that will then focus on outputs and outcomes, partnership between the cities and the national government. So we believe that there's greater scope for increase in borrowing and own revenue directed towards this developmental objective. We believe that the cities need to account for their performance. You need to call them here to begin to account for their performance. Cabinet, you know, at the national level, they need to be called to account for their performance, because in a way now, you are kind of elevating them to like a province in a way. So they have to account for the performance of their outcomes in this case as they get the money. And I think what we see also is that we need to identify capacity gaps, and that's what we are working on now with the metros, starting with the metros, and begin to help them to address their gaps in terms of their ability to plan, in terms of their ability to raise their own revenue to borrow. Those are the major areas that we are looking at. But when you look at the rural areas, the issues of institutional arrangement, starting from the function at the national level, starting from the relationship between your districts and the role of districts versus your locals, are quite fundamental in terms of, and those are probably big issues, you know, that really government needs to look at. But then the issues of addressing capacity becomes quite critical. And then once you sort those things, then as the cities also begin to move in with their own, then we can begin to create more room for more funding to flow into this area to address what is actually their critical problem, infrastructure access. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nala. You raised an issue of funds that are being flowing the other direction. I would like you, before we interact, there is an issue of the MIC. I don't know what they call it, MIC funding, that is supposed to be allocated to sports. And now we need to get an understanding, because sports is claiming that the grant that has been allocated to human settlements, which is urban settlements development grant, they are claiming that that is their grant. So at least we thought it would be important for us to get a clarity what is the situation, because our interpretation is totally different. But we cannot just take that decision to say we are on the right track unless we get a full understanding from the National Treasury.
The MUIC was formed out of consolidation of many other grants that were flowing to municipalities. And I think it was well acknowledging that, you know, municipalities are at the center of being able to plan, prioritize, and direct developments. And so the whole idea was, at that time, the whole of the grant was sitting with COCTA, then they would be the department then that begin to coordinate to ensure that municipalities, as they plan and prioritize, they are able to address all these issues in an integrated way, because you need to have scores where people are. You know, so who was best to determine where, you know, the issues are. So now part of the USDG grant is the portion of NIC. That is the truth, yes. Around 70% of the USDG is the portion of NIC that was going to these cities. So, and remember now, the principle here is that the cities should be actually be able to integrate and plan and manage, you know, developments better in their space. And then once you begin to say, now I'm taking the sports out, where is sports going to align with where the cities are going in terms of even your settlements, where they are, and begin to do. And I think once you do that also, you also miss the ability to leverage cities' funding to actually do more, which is what we actually want to be able to know, to make sure that we can sit at the national and begin to look at their plans and begin to see how much are these plans actually creating sustainable. Because sustainable human settlement, I think you've got to have where people can play, you know, can pray, as the minister sometimes said, and then they can have economic opportunities and stuff. So when you isolate that, it becomes a problem. So what we are saying to the Department of Women's of Sports is, be part of this process that is actually creating an urban environment for cities to actually do much more. I mean, as I was in Ikurulen, they were building a beautiful stadium. I don't know which area, but in some of this area around Katong stuff, very beautiful stadium that is going to be multi-purpose, you know, and the city is building. So what they are looking at is that where you have got concentration of, you are also having sports facilities. And what we are also saying with the department is that, okay, they have to be part of that process and begin to really see whether the cities are not spending on sports. And when they look at the budget of the city, they will see that actually they are spending on sports. And probably they could be spending more than what they would actually spend with the grant. So the issue is about being able to be part of the process. And I think one of the major challenges with the departments is to be able to know how to influence the process without actually controlling the cash. You know, and I think and that is where the major problem is, that either I control the cash, therefore I can. So that is looking at inputs. And if we are saying as a national government, we are moving towards outcomes, you know. So the issue of who controls the cash doesn't really matter. What you are looking at is, are we getting the outcomes that you are looking for? And I think for me, it needs a change of the mindset at that level. Secondly, when you look at outside of the cities, the solution also needs to, the department needs to look at what is the best solution, because that is where your education becomes part of the solution. Because if you have got sports facilities that then are integrated in the education in those villages there, rather than to go and have sports ground somewhere separate, you know, and then now as we build more schools, are we able as part of the norm to make sure that there are sporting facilities in the schools? And that's what we are looking at. And that in itself also outside of the cities, it begins to be part of the solution that we said, look at it. What is your strategy to address in these different areas? And then you will find that actually there is money in the system. You need to begin to influence the system, so that then you are bringing proper norms and standards in the system to achieve the outcomes that you're looking for. Thank you.
You are welcome, Honorable Richard. Honorable members, you want to first kick that?
I'm just sorry, because in terms of the parliament, there are a lot of problems. The point that I wanted just to make follow-up on the MIG one, Chair, is that I think there's a point that, because it's treasury, I think it's very important for us to raise this also. That I think the sport colleagues are raising the point that when the MIG grant was under their jurisdiction, simply means that under the ministry, they were able to build more sporting facilities. Since it shifted, I think now it's under COPTA, something that I think is COPTA. Now there are no sporting facilities that are built in many places. And then I think it's a bigger issue than their cry. I'm not sure it's a justified cry or it's not justified. But I think they're raising this matter in every meeting we meet with them. Generally, in cluster meeting, another meeting, they raise this issue that they feel really that is no longer helping them to build more sporting facilities for communities.
Honourable members, Honourable Stolle, Honourable Spain, Honourable Bowman, okay.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I want to thank the Treasurer for the report, because it was an eye-opener for us. But my just one clarity question. They talk about that dumping of funds to municipalities. What I want to find out, what are they doing to help those municipalities? Because those are reality. Because most of the time, when funds are not being utilized by national or provinces, at the end of the financial year, they just dump it to municipality. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I also would like to thank Treasury for putting this together. I don't think there's much here that is new to us. What is important is that it's been sort of summarized in a way where I think it's one can probably point directly to problems in the past. What I'd like to ask, Chairperson, is if perhaps the presenter can just respond or elaborate a little bit more. One of the statements that was made was current funding is not responding to informal settlements. So perhaps if she could just elaborate on that, because at the same time she has correctly pointed out that whilst the actual grant in financial terms have increased dramatically, the delivery is decreased. Something that I've pointed out on a number of occasions. Then I think notwithstanding that the proposal in terms of the living cities, integrated cities, where people play, pray, do everything else together, has been on the cards and has been in the mindset of people involved in human settlements for a number of years now. The crux of the problem probably, and irrespective of whether funding is for different things are located differently, at the end of the day, I think you touched on it, the planning still has to bring it all together, irrespective of where the funds are. And probably part of the problem or the crux of it is again, you put your finger on it, is that there's no clear assignment of functions. And therefore, at the end of the day, nobody sort of takes responsibility for anything. Because I think you're going to do it, and you think I'm going to do it, and then nobody does it. And the other question that I've got is, in the conclusion, again, a statement was made about more funding. Now, I don't believe that more funding is necessarily going to address the issue. Until we actually spend what we've got more efficiently, there's really no point in throwing more money at the problem. And that now brings me to something that has not been mentioned at all. And that is, and I think I speak on behalf of the entire committee, that we were quite shocked by a presentation last week that indicated that probably up to 80% of past performance of houses supposed to have been delivered are in fact in some way or another not up to standard and has to be some of them demolished and rebuilt. Now, I mean, that is taking us completely backwards. And at some point we're going to have to face this problem. How do we address it now in terms of going forward whilst we still have to address what went wrong in the past? So I'd like Treasury's input on this, because I'm not sure if you now give a conditional grant for human settlements, which is conditional And my interpretation is it's got to be spent on future housing or new housing. Because in effect, if we go back and rectify, we're going to spend money on a house that we've allocated money for already. So I'd like to know what your viewpoint is in terms of how do you ring-fence money from the conditional grant for that? And then lastly, Chairperson, just on the municipal accreditation. Yesterday, a statement was made in the House about the, and correctly so, that municipalities were congratulated, but Etiquini was mentioned as well. And I posed a question last week to the department, and I don't think it was answered, where I actually questioned whether Etiquini was, in fact, accredited. And today, Treasury sits before us, and they say Etiquini has got no status. So once again, my question is, where exactly do we stand in an... Pardon? So I need clarity on that, Chair, because like I say, on the department's website, it says Etiquini doesn't have any accreditation. The newspaper articles, and from the MEC in KZN, said they were, and like I say, yesterday a statement was made in the House saying Etiquini does have accreditation. And I think it's important that we actually, and that Etiquini know whether they've got accreditation or not. Thank you, Chair.
I had it straight from the horse's mouth, as far as I'm aware, that Etiquini was accredited. Because I also questioned that before making the statement. But perhaps we could have clarity. I want to thank you both ladies for your presentation this morning. I think it is, as the chairperson said, it's very helpful to us to have, instead of just reading it up always, to have a presentation like this. It gives us a fuller understanding. I think Honourable Steyn has already picked up on much of what I wanted to say. This current funding not responding to informal settlement statement, and I think and it sort of goes with the question of not more money, but it's really how we're using the money that we've got. And I just had a word with the chairperson the other day, and going through the estimates here, we've got a lot of money. We've got a lot of money that we've got for use. And when you add it all up, especially now in the context of human settlements, it's not only the 22 billion rand that's sitting under our portfolio and our vote, but it's all the rest, and we're looking like something like 122 billion. Now, that's a lot of money, but it's how we use it that I think becomes a problem. And then it also leads to the question of density that was mentioned and the densification policy. And if you go to our cities, and we've just been to Itikweni and Umsunduzi, and you look out and you've just got all these new single units out there. Now, we've been talking densification policy for, I don't know since when, for many years now, and yet we're not seeing the effect of that. And so now that scarce land has been taken up with all these little dotty houses instead of maybe going up. And I've mentioned this before. A couple of years ago I was in Madrid, and I tell you, that city has just got blocks and blocks, and they're building, and the cranes are there, and these flats are going up, and they're nice flats, nice brickwork, and so that, they're going to be easily maintained. Now, my question is, why have we not got this densification program going sooner? So I think that is the one thing. On the accreditation, and all of what I'm saying is actually linked together, because on the accreditation, I want to understand properly. I understand the fact that the different levels that we've got, and it's going to place a huge responsibility on this committee and our oversight. And we've been on the ground, so now we've got first-hand information and of what we want from this program, from the municipalities. We want to see better quality of housing, and we want to see faster delivery. We want to see value for money. Now, what I need to understand is, with the level 2 accreditation, that does not include the financial portion of this. That still rests with the province. And I'd like a bit of clarity here, because I want to be clear in my mind when we are doing oversight. And this whole question of where does the buck stop, you know? So I would like to understand that quite clearly. On the question of MIG, I want to just comment about that, because you've rightly said that originally that was bringing together all these little funds and it put them into one fund. So in a sense, that was already coordinating, bringing those funds. And I think we've taken another step forward now. And so I think that can only strengthen our work there. Can I just also refer to us to the your slide on your challenges in mostly background challenges in mostly rural municipalities? You talk about backlogs. In basic services, estimated at 70% in electricity, 65% in water, 79% in sanitation, and housing only 19%. That's 79% that you're talking about in sanitation. Can you give us a clearer understanding of what we are talking about there? And I think I'm saying this, we're talking about rural sanitation. And are we referring to pipe structures, digging holes, putting bowls? You know, when we talk about 79% backlog in rural areas, and this is really of concern to us,
we could have a clearer understanding of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll deal with it issue by issue. So on the damping of funds, like Malajinga rightly said, there's no transparency in the fiscal flows between provinces and municipalities. And what we've tried to do in the Division of Revenue, and we've tried this since 2006, is to get, firstly, for provinces who use municipalities as developers, which the Housing Act allows them to do, to actually gazette those allocations. And we have the provision also in Section 15 of this year's DORA. That would allow them to, one, gazette money, but two, also to agree on a payment schedule so that we can also see how the funds flow and when they flow. That gives some kind of transparency in all of that. It helps us to see our provinces transferring money to municipalities when they're supposed to do so, and that it also allows us to see more clearly whether they are just damping half of the money towards the end of the financial year. You know, the statement that the current funding doesn't respond to informal settlements. I mean, we've all seen provinces make high priority statements about informal settlements, but the way the housing subsidy is structured doesn't allow them to specifically target informal settlements. We have an informal settlements upgrading program, but because provinces are chasing numbers on delivering of housing, informal settlement upgrading doesn't necessarily mean giving somebody a house, but it's around security of tenure, access to services, giving somebody an address, getting a fire brigade in there when there's an emergency and all of that. And it tends to be a kind of a low priority area. And Anton, you can actually help me out, because I think towards the end of last year when we looked at how the provincial business plans and you looked at the informal settlement upgrading program, provinces only spent 14% of the conditional grant allocations on the UISP program, or subsidy instrument. I think the challenge for us is moving away from the way the subsidy is currently structured to serve households in a specific income sector means tested, and how do you get to area-based development, because then you get to see, which is what the UESDG does, is you start seeing how provinces, or how we move into getting areas developed getting the community facilities in there, the sports facilities in there, and linking that to transport. So how do we, so I think the difficulty on changing our subsidy stream or subsidy instrument is how do you move towards an area-based development that would allow for informal settlement and trading to become a priority in urban areas. I think on the quality control and how do we fund, it's rightly like the Honourable Member said, it's not about more money, but it's about how do we use this money efficiently. So and the quality control in housing, how the norms and standards is what we need to apply. I mean, this to me largely comes from contract management issues, the role the NHBRC plays in quality control, so when do they go out, when projects are enrolled, when they go out to inspect all of that, whether provinces are managing contracts effectively, so whether provinces go out and do the necessary inspections before they pay money over, and those are the issues. I mean, the department has a rectification program, which is another subsidy instrument in the human settlements development grant to provinces, and you can actually see money increasing on that. But yes, you like the Honourable Members rightly say, it's about how do we then get the NHBRC to play their role properly, to go and do the, I mean, it's one first is about provinces enrolling projects on time, enrolling the homes on time, getting the NHBRC to come out and inspect on time, and then get provinces to manage their contracts properly. And that's the challenge, is that provinces shouldn't be paying contractors for shoddy work. Yet they do. So I mean, we need to look at that. And I mean, I don't know if it means we have to tighten up the rectification policy in the housing code. I am tempted to push the reaccreditation and the non-financial administration and the program management and that onto the department. It's a policy issue that the department can answer on all of that. Do you want to answer the question on the rural housing, or do you want me to? The rural issues. I mean, I think the numbers on the rural sanitation and the backlog deals with inadequate sanitation in terms of the MDG, the Millennium Development Goal. So it's people who don't have access to a proper sanitation facility, a bucket. Those are what we're talking about. So it's people below that RDP standard of a VIP or some kind of brick latrine.
Am I talking anything? Yes, I think maybe if I can add on the issue of the first question that was asked around how we avoid dumping. Just to add that in the Division of Revenue Act, we have got a section there, I think section 10.8, that actually empowers the national department to ensure that the provinces do allocate, indicate clearly what is the money that will go to the cities, whether they are going to spend themselves or whether they are, you know, transferring, that they indicate that up front and actually gazette that money. So I think it was, you know, an attempt also to begin to strengthen even that alignment between your infrastructure and your housing, or force that planning between the provinces and the cities in a way. So I think the challenge here would be how we actually monitor this thing and actually make it happen between us and the national department. Okay. Section 10.8. Yeah, of the Division of Revenue B. Yeah, 10.8, yeah. Section 10.8. I think it's 10.8.
You want to make a follow-up?
Chairperson, I'm quite disturbed about this bucket system in the rural areas. People in the rural areas doesn't use buckets. They go to the bushes and mountains. Then where on earth is this rural area with bucket system?
I think that one has to be responded by the department, because when they were presenting, it came out of my mind to say, the department should take a responsibility on this one. We were in KZN, and that was not the first time. We were in Gauteng. People were telling us boldly to say, in our province, we do not have bucket system. And that was very disturbing, very disturbing. We are from KZN. I don't want to discuss the KZN report now, but what we have observed there, it's very, very bad. I think the department has to really, really take a responsibility to ensure that what do they mean when they talk about bucket system. They have to explain to the portfolio committee. And then we are going to challenge them when we receive that statement. And in the presentation on rural household infrastructure grant, we are getting that that grant is also provide water. And that is not the interpretation that we receive from the department. Because that rural infrastructure, we just build toilets. There's nothing that is mentioned about water. So we want to understand if the department is having the same understanding that we had. They were not aware. They did not understand properly when this grant was allocated. Because as I'm saying now, the department has rolled out infrastructure, I mean this grant, and they are dealing with Migodi. There is nothing that relates to water. Technical plastic are getting, And then the second point I want to relate to it is the issue of accreditation. We want to know, yes, we all in agreement that there is a dire need for the municipalities, more especially the metros, to be accredited. But there is a critical question on the management of beneficiaries. Want to know from the because everything goes back to the department. You can blame the municipality, you can blame the province, but the people who are accounting to us is the national department. How did they reach to an extent that certain municipalities should be accredited? The national management all over the show, all over the show, is a problem. We want to know what is your role to address that issue. Because you don't tell us about the national data register, national database, because it does not work. And you know that it does not work. What is your strategy to address this as soon as possible? We need to know. We were in KZN. It's a mess. Go to the province will tell you something else. Go to the municipality. The municipality will never be ashamed. The metro is not ashamed to tell you that really we are unable to manage the beneficiary list. What do you do if the metro cannot? What do you expect from the local municipality? Can I get responses?
Thank you, Chair. Let me thank also our colleagues from National Treasury for the presentation. Honourable members, the small issue that I would like to deal with is the issue that relates to accreditation, and I wouldn't like to go into detail about the confusion that has evolved around it. But to further confirm to the Honourable Member that Etiwini does have a status, and it was confirmed, and the certificate was issued and given on the day to the MEC and the Mayor. Chair, I was a witness to the occasion. As a matter of fact, I was the program director for that particular occasion. So I can affirm and put it and place it on record that Ethekwini is accredited. I do understand the confusion, and I won't blame the National Treasury for the comment made here. At the time you prepared this, I would understand that the matter was not resolved at that particular stage, but the matter has been resolved, Chair. I would like to get into details of what has led into that confusion. So I would like to confirm that and place it on record as I did in the last meeting. The issue of diversification, Chair, I think it's the issue that is receiving our attention. I'm sure that you have followed very closely the direction that the minister has taken on densification and the emphasis on densification, and also the issue of trying to make our policy prescript to be more emphatic on this particular guidance, which is a new wave of thinking in delivering of low-cost housing. The issue of densification has been mainly linked to social housing. I think there is a change in the paradigm shift to begin to focus densification on low-cost housing. Last week, I had an opportunity of visiting one province last Sunday just to get a sense of how densification on a low-cost-based housing can work in practical sense, and it is a doable exercise. So there is that shift. We are moving towards that shift. It's a matter of ensuring that the cost implications of doing densification from a low-cost perspective is also well-managed, because it comes with a new dimension in terms of how to make sure that you also manage the cost that gets involved with geotechs and all the things that goes with that. But it's a doable thing, and we are beginning to promote that. And as I've said, I've seen practically on the ground, it is doable, and we are trying to move towards that. That will also help us, as the member Bollman has indicated, to effectively use the limited land that we have at our disposal for delivery of human settlements. So it's a very important dimension to take. And I'm sure Neville can also talk more, because he's been working very closely on the policy prescript side of that. I think the issue of sanitation, Chair, I think we may have a separate presentation on sanitation to the committee. As I've promised before, after the issue was raised upon your visit from Ethekwini, that I would like us to do a full presentation to the committee with regard to matters relating to sanitation in terms of our program, in terms of the challenges, and in terms of us moving forward, based on your assessment that you did on your visit. And I would further request, Chair, that opportunity is presented to us to reflect on our sanitation problem as the department, having taken that function from the Department of Water Affairs. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, just on the issue related to the question of the basic infrastructure and the informal settlement households, I mean, as we've indicated previously, one of the issues that we're having to deal with is that within provinces there's a focus on house construction. So what that does is that utilizes a substantial amount of the subsidy for house construction, because we, as you know, it consumes a substantial amount. The net result of that has been that you've left a huge and a substantial amount of households in informal settlements behind. So that's why you have this growing basic infrastructure services backlog to households in informal settlements. So with the urban migration, you're finding there's this gap. So and the reason you have that gap is that there were three different phases in our human settlements housing construction. Between 1994 and 1999, there was a focus on land release. There was some house construction, and there was servicing of stands. And then you had, 2000 to 2004, and you had a substantial amount of servicing that took place. Now what's happening is that you're having construction of houses on those service stands. So what you're doing is you're servicing people that have already, or households that have already had, access to basic services. Your extension of basic services is not happening. As part of outcome 8, as Mali Jengs has raised, there's a focus, and we indicated last year, I mean at the last presentation, we're now trying to move that mindset, because there's a huge amount of households, and we appear to have, I think there's a substantial amount of success in getting provinces to change that mindset. But as we've indicated, there's also a policy decision that we're going to have to take, particularly as government, around the sustainability issues of house construction versus extension of houses. It's a policy issue, and we'll have to come back on that. On the issue of densification, Chair, it's a confirmed policy, and I think the one difficulty that we have in South Africa is the cost of densification, the costs attached to densification. So your average unit, not only the unit, is about 230,000, ranges between 230 up to about 330. There's land or associated property acquisition costs. So that's been the one issue that. And it then comes back to, I think, an issue, and we've come back, and outcome 8 does that and assists us. It says, here's informal settlements, here's affordable rental, here's land release, and that. Because I think the one issue that we've always had to deal with is that we've got 37 programs in the housing code, and I think the question we've come back to, and I think through outcome 8 and the minister, DG, and the president's contract, is that we need to focus on things that we can do, focus on things that we can do well, rather than doing a whole range of things and not doing anything well. So that's been, I mean, it's been the refocus and repackaging the issue. That the other important issue, Chair, and I think it's been raised, is around the question of the MIG funding for sport and recreation. We said we'll come back to you on this issue, but you know, the one issue around that is that it's a departmental issue, and the DG is taking up that, because you know, although you build, and there was a substantial amount of sport and recreation facilities that were constructed, the issue is that once you've done that, the question of operational maintenance and ongoing management becomes a problem. And that then is a local authority issue. And local authorities have kept on coming back and saying, you blame us for these things, but then when national and province comes into our areas, they don't consult with us as to whether or not we have the means and capacity to be able to manage that. And I'm sure you, as members of committee, you've seen a number of post-94 facilities that we've developed that are in bad state, poor management. And it's an issue that we said we need to deal with. So it's how do we consult and how do we sort of integrate to ensure that that happens. I mean, the fact of the matter is that as a capital grant, we can go in and spend that money. Then what? And as government, we end up then getting a bad name around those issues. I just want to raise the issue around the question of accreditation. The level 2 accreditation speaks about program management and administration, and this includes project evaluation and approval, contract administration, subsidy registration, program management, including cash flow projection management, technical construction, and quality assurance. I suppose we need to come back to the committee and explain to you what that means. But in relation to the beneficiary administration, Chair, it's been a vexed question all along, and it is, as we sit now, it remains a responsibility of who the developer is. So if the province is the developer and there's a contract, then that developer becomes responsible for the program management, the beneficiary management of that area. The one issue that we've said we need to go back is and re-look at our whole aspect, and it comes back to the house construction I mean, you know, what we need to perhaps do is it a complex issue? Because what happens is that, and there's numerous examples of this, you had situations where a stand was serviced in 2000. There was not enough money to then build a house. So you come back and you build a house in 2006. So it's a 6-year lapse. But when you get back to the house, or when you come back in 2006, the same family is not residing there. So what happens is that you've now got to deregister that family. That takes a court. I mean, the question we need to ask ourselves is our rules, regulations, and administrative processes, particularly in relation to the poor, can we administer them? Do we have the capacity, and can we afford to do that? And these are questions we need to be able to ask, because then does it become, is it an issue of corruption or maladministration? Thanks.
I think the issue here, the oversight, because you play an oversight, because you cannot go there and coordinate the beneficiary list. But I think the important issue, do you have mechanisms in place to, because people, when they are frustrated, they don't go to the municipalities. They come to us, and we have to link with that, those complaints with you. Some do come to you. So the issue here is the monitor. Do we have in place strict mechanisms to oversee that this thing is done properly? Mr.
Maso, you want to add on what I was saying? Okay, let me just finish up now. Okay. Mine is covered by Senam. Because the problem is that it was 2009 or 2010 when we were visiting Matete. When we are sitting down, there's somebody who's going to control the beneficiary, is a developer. It's another issue now. Because the developer is going to ask for a beneficiary all over. We had a certain program about a developer. Being somebody who's got to manage the beneficiary. And then we must change that. And I thought that we'll be through with it, that one. Thanks.
No, I think it's a homework, because that question of a developer, we requested you to define a developer in this instance. Because when we refer this to a developer, we believe that the developer is the municipality, not a contractor in this issue. So I think that is why it is important that you develop a policy that is going to be to clearly define the money, because money, they do differ it when we did come to another level. So, Mr. Aran, it's like that. A developer in this instance is not the contractor, it's the municipality. But your definition does not clarify that. That's what we are talking about. Honorable Bowman, Honorable Stein.
I just want to follow up on this whole beneficiary thing and where the chairperson has been going with this as well. And the oversight of that. In an informal settlement, and I'm talking now from experience, you may not think so, but I am, you've got a number of different people who are living there. You've got those, and now you're saying to us that you've got all these different options that you can offer to people. And within that informal settlement, there are people that can take up those options. So you've got people who not necessarily will qualify for an RDP house, because they're actually making big bucks. I've had them. They're actually depriving somebody of an RDP house, but because they've got that land and because they're sitting there, they're expecting to get that RDP land. You no sooner give them that RDP house, and you go there, and we thought when we went, there's an enormous big structure now that gets built around that, because now they've got the money and that's fine. But the point is, do we have the capacity to actually sift so that we're not saying that everybody in this informal settlement must get an RDP house? Do we have the management process that can oversee that to say, that's offering to a person in that report, you know, you're just coming in here from the country because you want work, you really could go into rental accommodation, and we've got this to offer to you. And it's mainly in the cities that it happens. Can we get to a situation where we can manage it like that and not be completely swamped with an increased number of people that need to be given houses? Instead of us bringing this down, it's just growing and growing.
Thank you, Chair. I want to make a comment and put a question to the DG, but I don't expect an answer. I want him to take that question back with him. And when they do come and give us more information on the accreditation, that perhaps he can address it. And my question is simply this. First of all, we've got Treasury that have come before us today, and I assume then that this is the latest information. Now, the DG contradicts us, and he basically says, I must do as he says and not as he does. Because he's saying, I'm not going to explain the details, but I can tell you we handed over the certificate. So my question to the DG is this. Based on what the chairperson said, based on what you've heard from us unofficially in terms of what we've seen in KZN, in Tequini in particular, how is it possible that they could have qualified for the accreditation? Given all those weaknesses, given what has happened there, given the SIU investigation, all those things. That's the question I want him to take back with him when they come and explain to us. How do you accredit a municipality that have got so many blatant shortcomings in terms of the whole process? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, my point has been overtaken by the contribution by Mrs. Bowman, because on this question of the informal settlement and the fact that it is becoming more and more difficult to solve the problem of the informal settlements in terms of providing housing, I was going to ask whether it is not possible, or rather, whether it is not time now for a thorough study of those areas to be made to find out exactly who qualifies there for the housing and who does not qualify. Because we all know that in those informal settlements, people waiting to be given by the department as people houses, there are people who've got beautiful homes in the Eastern Cape and elsewhere. Big, beautiful homes. So it's not that, for instance, all the people in the informal settlements really are desperate for accommodation. But how are we going to solve this? Because as long as we're not able to do that, people will continue migrating from the rural areas to the urban areas. And even if they have jobs, like you have here in Cape Town, for example, some people have got jobs. But because they don't want to spend money paying rent in the townships, then they go and build their shacks in the informal settlements. And here comes the department and it gives them land because somehow they seem to qualify as people who are desperate for accommodation. But you are actually giving accommodation to a person who can afford. I don't know what we can do, but I think that there is a problem here, and I can see it, you know, coming through, that it is what we have been saying. But how, I think we need to sit down. Sometimes we feel like saying, is it possible, I know this is not possible, but is it possible to have a moratorium on providing houses for some time? And let us sit down and really plan and see how we can find solutions to the problem. You see, because even if you talk about density, we all know why, for instance, the density in our urban areas is what it is in South Africa. It's because of the settlement pattern by the apartheid system. You see, we've got to start from that point. It's really It's affecting, we can say it's affecting all these programs. The very fact that we are settled the way we are. Now, sometimes, as we have been discussing, people asking questions, I also ask myself a question. The Planning Commission, led by Minister Manuel, Trevor Manuel, is it not looking at this problem? You know, the problem of settlement in South Africa. It is a big problem. When we say we want to bring people closer to the economic areas of the city, take Joburg, take Soweto. What are you going to do? Are you going to bring those people from Soweto to Ilof Street? It is not possible. It is impossible. So for me, I don't know. I just think that maybe we shouldn't hurry so much to say we have delivered. Now I'm talking to the ruling party. Maybe really, I think that we shouldn't hurry to say, in 2011 we delivered 3 million houses. But I think what we should do is to say, where do we deliver these houses? Should we deliver them now? Or should we first look at the problem and see how we can solve the problem? Mind you, I'm not even talking about my village, Ngolongolo. You have not talked about Ngolongolo. You have not talked about Mthwaku. You have not talked about the RDP houses, Ekobokop, Etumakala, and so on and so forth. Because there are problems, the way they have been done and where they have been put. You bring 400 units to a town, a small town, that hardly can provide, say, 50 jobs. But you bring people from the rural areas, the villages, and you put them close to Kaiskamahu. There are no jobs. There in Sadahem, Holoha, I think about 500 to 600 units, there are no jobs. And it's just like that everywhere. So I think when you say there is money in the system, we agree there is money in South Africa. There is money in the system, not only in the Department of Human Settlement, but generally. There is money in the system. You ask yourself the question, should we have built street waters in King Williamstown? I'm sure the committee has been there, I think, at some point. But those houses, you know, it's so sad to see them. And to say to yourself, if for instance you had taken this money and offered it in form of scholarships, wouldn't it have been better? You know. So I'm just saying the planning for me is what we probably should be looking at rather than having to say we have built so many units this year. I think we need to put it down every year. Thank you, Chairperson.
I think the issue that is raised by Honorable Njobe is very critical for us as the policymakers. Kulula ukuthi we bring people to the areas of work. It's a good question. Tell me, abantu ngiyabasa Soweto uzabafulisha ubazise city center? Just because you are saying they are bringing people to the areas of work. Well, it's good. There are people who are working in the city center. But is it, because, you know, that does not relate to national treasures. It relates to us as policymakers to define our policies. What do we mean when we say this? Because we cannot pull out about what we call uthi ubazisa i-city center because we are still perpetuating the migration. Now it's good to address this, but we have to see the balance. So that is why it is important, this clustering, the economic cluster, because uMinister Lindimthande ngenxesha, uMinister always remind us that housing, yes, does look at the issues of social aspect. But housing is an economic issue. So, because the opportunities must come to the people.
People settle. When they settle, what next? There has to be a shop. There has to be a school. There has to be a mall. Whatever you can call it. But we try to run away from that reality. As us, as politicians, we need to discuss that. So that we guide at least ODG at some stage. I think they really need that guidance from us as politicians. Really, what do we mean? We sit in a room, sit on the informal, and then we discuss these issues. Just an informal setup. We just become honest to each other, so that when you establish or you develop those policies, I think I normally raise this issue of post-Berat. Post-Berat is very crucial for the human settlements family. This is the time that we have a post-Berat. Let's hope that you are going to find it.
Find it, Chair. I'm tempted. I can't wait until it's finished. We definitely find that, as you know, I've spoken about looking into the new strategy for human settlements. It's basically what it needs to do to begin to unpack how we have performed in the past in the sector, how we want to unpack the new mandate of human settlements, and moving forward, what fundamental policies we need to begin to review and change them to improve on our service delivery. Chair, we are ready at any time. I was telling my colleague now that, as a matter of fact, the consultants on board can't wait to meet with all of you to begin to look into those issues quite deeply. So we are on board, Chair.
I don't need the answer now. That's why from the information we have just received from the National Treasury, I would like the department to come more with information about the rural household infrastructure grant. At least now, I don't say now. At least now we need something better than what we have received. Thanks.
Okay. I just thought I should comment on this, you know, this issue of finding solutions around densification, around how you bring people together with the employment opportunities. Because I think clearly what, government sees is that you give a person a house, and that person, there's a house, but it's not even an asset that you can do anything. It's in a poor, it's income poor, it doesn't help. So I think as you deliberate on these issues, I think it will be nice to actually call it in some of the cities. Just let them to show you how they begin to address this issue. Because my sense is, it's not an issue also that can be addressed outside of the cities by national government. It has got to be a collaborative effort that then begins to see how the cities are directing this. Because I mean, when you look at Joburg, they actually have a plan, and obviously to begin to change the special form of the city is something that will take a long time. But it's an issue of whether those additional developments that you are putting now, are they beginning to direct development in that direction? Because it's an issue of how even the cities also regulate the private sector investment, directing them to where they invest, because you are actually trying to bring people and jobs closer. And one of those is also your mass transit systems, where the transport also becomes cheaper. Like, for instance, in areas like Soweto Orange Farm, what they are looking at is the transport corridor to actually make transport very cheap, while also they are looking at how around Orange Farm also they can begin to make sure that they direct development in terms of economic development. So they have got a plan, but it's an issue of, does everybody see this plan? And then begin to assist, in the manner that we are investing, whether it's through ESCOM and all this parastatals, to begin to enable actually the cities to achieve that. Are they also able to regulate? Because one of the things that we have seen is the cities themselves don't actually want to regulate developments properly, because they do have the regulation power of where the companies can the investments can be in industries. But also what we call development charges, where the companies internationally normally would have to pay for the bulk infrastructure, that
the cities is putting in place. That is called development strategy. And what we have seen is that a lot of the time the cities do not do that properly because, one, the policy has never been clear, and the framework for how you implement that has never been very clear. And as a result, you have got developers also being subsidized in a way which money that could actually go to the poor. So what we are setting out now is that we want better clarity in that post so that the cities also then they can actually get for economic investment that benefits developers and your company, your industry and stuff, they pay for the bulk. It's an international practice. And that in itself, plus directing where these developments are going, aligned with where the city it's wanting to go in terms of its growth, then it becomes part of the solution. So what I'm just saying is part of what you can do is just have to call them, let them just see, because then it will begin to help you begin to see how, you know, together different phases of government actually can begin to work, but with the cities actually being the core of how, you know, we direct these things. If they're not going the right direction, you need to be able to say, no, but you need to go in this way, you know, rather than to say, we will do it from here, because then that also now begins to fragment and go in different directions.
Okay. Goodbye.
Thank you, Chair. We thank the committee for all the comments made, and on matters that we still have to come back, we'll do so, as we normally do. That will also include, Chair, the process regarding the accreditation. As you have raised concerns in the last meeting about the entire situation, we will be ready to do that. That will clarify how certain decisions were arrived at, which I think is of fundamental importance for the committee to note. That also include our presentation for future regarding sanitation function as it relates to human settlement. We will do those things, Chair. But maybe I must say to my honourable member that I don't tell members to do what they should do. I simply respond. I'm the last person as the accounting officer to do that to the honourable members. So if it has come out like that, my apologies, Chair.
Yes. Thank you very much, National Treasury, for your contribution, and you have made a very, very good input that is going to assist us in taking forward our oversight role. And I think I know that you interact with the department in most times, but I think it was a good exercise that we are here together today so that we pick up issues and then we try to solve in a collective manner. Because if someone understands something the other way, so it, sometimes it causes a lot of problems. But if we are here together, it's good that we have a clear way forward how to address these issues. Also, thank the department for coming. We know that you are always there whenever we need you. And and we also thank the AG. I don't think it's your day today. It's not your day. So I'm sure you don't feel uncomfortable. We are still going to call you. It's good that you are here, but we still have to engage with the department on some of the issues that were raised by the AG in the report of the AG. We need to make follow-ups on that one. So we appreciate your efforts to visit us. It's very much important to us that you are here. I think we are not having any item today, as I have mentioned in the beginning of my meeting, but there is an announcement for the members. Next week we are going for our threat plan, and this information is going to assist us when we are planning our next financial program and activities. So, Kolisa, I think Kolisa can assist the members.
can bring us to meet you for information of the
venues. Oh, the venues are going to be... Oh, there's tea outside. All of us, let's get tea. And then the information, I think, is underway. And then about the KZN report, it's going to be circulated soon. But I must say that in the last few pages, it's not yet refined. It's still going to be refined. But we felt that the first draft should come out so that members can add whatever they feel that it has been omitted. And then next week, because we're not going to have any portfolio committee, it's just a threat plan. And then in our threat plan, we adopt that report so that when we come back from the constituency work, it's tabled in Parliament so that we can be able to effect our recommendations. Thank you. Let's get tea, and then we...
Tuesday and Wednesday.
Tuesday, full day. Wednesday, half day. We'll sleep over on Monday. Amdobe, I think your issues were very much important. We invite you to a thread and don't send somebody else.
I'm just talking about Tuesday.
What is the problem?
Eh?
If it could be Wednesday, the whole day, personally, I wouldn't mind. But
No. We can't have a full day on Wednesday because as far as the Parliament is that. But on Tuesday, there's nothing. We are clear that on Tuesday, there's nothing. So that is why we are taking a half day on Wednesday. I ask Parliament, yeah, change that change. This is Mastunge.
I'm not sure. You didn't say anything.
Nothing else on the
agenda? No, there isn't. I'm actually not sure. For me as well.
Thank you.